This is the most important session of the week, why Christians must think, or my most important session. I've been going to Bible study every morning and trying to remember Alan's prayer, which he wants us to say together. But he didn't let us say it, so I couldn't remember it.
I've written it down.
What? You wrote it down. That's good. Well, actually, I thought we could ask Alan to lead it again like he did this morning, responsibly.
John?
Can we pray?
Also, he wrote it down for me, and somebody else copied it, and it's going to be on the kiosk.
I copied them. They're printing it right now.
Well, we have Alan here. Let's pray.
What is it? Let's pray together. Spirit of the living God.
Spirit of the living God.
Come and grow our faith.
Come and grow our faith.
Deepen our hope.
Deepen our hope.
Strengthen our love.
Strengthen our love.
And come and water the desire within each of us.
And come and water the desire within each of us.
Be your faithful friends forever.
Be your faithful friends forever.
Unfortunately, I have to leave tomorrow. So instead of doing 5 sessions, I'm only doing 4, and then I just kind of got everything left that I got to do in the next hour. So I apologize for that because I'm going to have to do a little. I never talk about everything I want to talk about. But I do want to talk about a couple things that relate to what Alan was talking about this morning, and some of the things that Peter can talk about. I guess I'm going to put it up here. There's a concept in European law called, and I don't even quite know how to say it, lèse majesté. Ellen and I were in England in April. In fact, we took off on the day that the volcano erupted. So instead of landing in London, we landed in Paris and had a cars, trains, boats, taxi day getting to London. And then we stayed for a few days and we went to Hampton Gardens, which is the palace that Henry VIII started, and then William and, no, no. Yeah, and William and Mary completely altered and completed. And you go in, there's a throne room that you go into, and it's a bigger room than this. And when you walked into this room and out of this room, you had to face the king. Because you couldn't walk in, king way, turn around. Because that was insulting the majesty of the king. Right? I'm sorry to say that Alan chickened out this morning and said, the king, the king, the king,
yes,
the king. Did not try to say, ahas ueris. Did you notice that?
You see,
speak truth to power. I don't want to mess up your name, so I'll call you the king. And in fact, the name of the king. That's an important concept we have that is a little bit complicated. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it in a moment. In the Justinian Code, and in fact in Roman law, there was a phrase that I just put principi placuit. If you hear, it's a Latin phrase. The whole phrase, quod principi placuit vigorem legis habet. As I said, I don't do Latin well. But what pleases the prince, habet. H-O-B-B-I-T? No, A-G-B-E-T. What pleases the prince has the force of law. What pleases the prince, he was pleased.
Yeah.
Right? If, last night, if the prince or the pope is outside of the law, is above the frame, is above the law, what pleases the prince is what the law is for everybody else. Okay? George's Gregory VII's expansion of the powers of the Pope in the investiture crisis was based on the Justinian Code, the power of the Pope. What pleases the Pope is law. And Principes Legibus Solibus Est, the prince is not bound by the laws. The prince is sovereign, not the law. There was a wonderful man named John Figgis who has an interesting history I won't tell you, but he wrote a book about the concept of sovereignty. And here's what he said about the church. He wrote a lot about the church. In the Middle Ages, the church was not a state. It was the state. The state, or rather the civil authority for a separate society was not recognized, was merely the police department of the church. latter took over from the Roman Empire its theory of absolute and universal jurisdiction of the supreme authority, that is, the church did, and developed it into the doctrine of the plenitudo potestasis of the Pope, who was the supreme dispenser of law, the fountain of honor, including regal honor, and the sole legitimate earthly source of power, the legal, if not the actual founder of religious orders, universities, and university degrees, the supreme judge and divider among nations, the guardian of international right, the avenger of Christian blood. In our world, all these functions have passed elsewhere, not in the church. In the theory of omnipotence, which the popes held on the plea that any action might come under their cognizance so far as concerned morality, has now been assumed by the state. I would say been assumed by the government. On the analogous theory that any action, religious or otherwise, so far as it becomes a matter of money or contract, must be a matter for the courts. That's a powerful statement of how a natural state, as we've been talking about, the Ron John world, but we could call this the king and pope world, we could call this the church and state world, is organized. And the story of Esther is the story of a natural state. I don't want to erase truth here. I'll get to it. There's multiple dimensions. But for my pictures, you know, we have the dominant coalition of the powerful players for their organizations, Ron and John. King and Pope.
Cheat.
Cheating.
Right, Xerxes.
Yeah.
Easier. He said you're cheating.
I am cheating. I'm telling the truth, I'm cheating. That's how the story ends? Right? Does the goodness of the people change the dynamics of the society? Probably not. The Greek philosophers wanted wise and good kings, virtuous leaders, because they knew that the only possibility for getting a better society was changing the morals and ethics and behavior of these guys. And in fact, we tend, as in Les Majestés, as in George Bush invaded Iraq, or Barack Obama passed health care, to associate the person with all this collective stuff that goes on. Power is never wielded by a person. It is always wielded by an organization. Because power comes not from violence, it comes from organizing people. To wield violence, you must first organize it. Because any individual person can be easily overcome by two or more. So in order to understand the role of violence in the world, we need to understand how it gets organized. Now, often what happens when we talk about violence, as we did in Jim Hansen's discussion yesterday afternoon, we got to the case of, and if a person's here, my pack was killing me yesterday, so I laid down, which meant I didn't see anybody. And when Jim moved over to the side of the room, I didn't see him either. So I had sort of a audio tape version of his session. And the woman said, I'm an older woman. I have a gun by my bedside. If somebody comes in and is tearing up my house or maybe raping me, what should I do? Kill or be killed? Tough decision. Is that the only question with violence in our society? No. It is a question for us as individuals. But for society, it's not a bunch of individuals deciding to be violent together. That's not how armies work, right? And I'm sorry I missed yesterday. Because as we talk about the law of violence, we're talking about organizations. And whether torture is used, this whole discussion that Peter's been having is based on the fact that there's a legitimacy about using violence in a particular way, that John Hughes' memorandum changed the structure of that organization. And we have to recognize it's not John Yoo operating independently that's doing this, it's the organization of the government. So we really need to focus on the circle And we tend to focus on the name. Yeah. We elected Barack Obama, and you know, not enough has changed. Well, what did you expect to happen? Do you want to have a powerful enough president who can do whatever he damn well pleases? No, you don't. So you gotta accept when they, when even a guy you like, you think he's gonna do this stuff, can't do it. It ain't because he is failing, it's because the circle. Bind them. Organizations constrain. Rules do not describe organizations. Relationships are what organizations are about. Rules are about what happens in certain narrow circumstances. In the empire that Esther inherited, even though there was a law that said husbands have domination over their wives, did that mean in every family that husbands dominated wives? No. I'm sure of that. But when it meant that the organization of the family needed to go to the larger society to get third-party enforcement or some outside enforcement of their agreement, who won? The husband. That's what that law says. That's what that rule is. Okay? And we need to keep that in mind, that rules do not describe how we behave. They describe certain conditions that will apply when a relationship breaks down or when an action is taken. They are not the totality of our society. They are not the framework of our society. They are the pieces that enable us to build relationships. Yep.
Now, can you, describe why Nelson Mandela was able, as a leader, to step in and basically say stop? Difference between their society and the United States, where Barack Obama can't come in and say stop.
So, Alan, what did Nelson Mandela stop? In the example you used the other day.
Well, he was able to enter into a relationship, which then enabled conversation, which then enabled them to broker certain things. But there were some things that he was actually powerless to do. So. Literally 2 weeks before he came out of prison, he said he was going to nationalize the mines and the banks. After coming out, he couldn't do it. So there are some things that he may have been empowered to do, but there are certainly a hang of a lot of constraints. And we discover more and more constraints as time goes on in actual fact.
Right. So, but I think the specific example that you're referring to was when Mandela got the ANC to stop using violence. It wasn't that he got the government to stop using violence. It was that the situation had come to the point of these negotiations. If the Afro National Congress, the organization which Mandela was part of, not completely heading, we can pin it all on Mandela, but we don't want to do that, could say, we have to stop fighting because if we continue to use violence, the government's going to use more violence back. And we've reached a point at which we need to stop using violence or we can't go forward in these negotiations. Is that fair? So Mandela couldn't say to the society, oh, no more violence. He said to his group, we got to stop using violence. Why did they do that? Well, they had to perceive that it was in their best interest to do that. Right? Because Mandela's coalition was not legal. It did not draw on the resources of the government to organize it. Right? It was self-organizing. And the fact that the Afro National Congress was self-organizing initially is, in fact, one of the problems that South Africa faces. Right? Because it's been elected. And it gets elected, but its structure is, in fact, based upon being a revolutionary movement to overthrow. And its structure continues to be that, and it's beginning to fragment. And as it fragments, there are people who say, I know how to change the government, and I don't like what they're doing. So let's fragment the power structure. In America, there's a perfectly parallel example. How did the revolutionaries in America won the war? By first of all setting up committees of correspondence, publicizing the evils of the British Empire, which were essentially that the British were acting unconstitutionally and were corrupt. And then swinging public opinion behind them, it was never a case that all Americans were for independence. Many Americans were actively not. They left the country and we seized their property. And many were indifferent. So after the revolution, was over in the 1790s, and we started having elections. And there was a group in Philadelphia, the Democratic Republican Society, which began to get people together and encourage similar organizations in other cities to write papers, present them to one another, and then get the newspapers to publish them. And of course, they were questioning whether George Washington and the Federalists were actually acting in the right way, and this really upset Washington. Really upset Washington. He made a speech about it, but the Democratic Republican Society said, you know what? Washington is telling us that we are acting in a way that may be treasonous, but is certainly challenging the authority of the government. And they stopped doing it. And the reason they stopped doing it was because they realized that what they were doing was exactly how they brought down the English government. Do they want to bring down their own government? That was a tough problem. So, what I want to talk about today, I want us to keep in mind this notion of a natural state. As being the natural way to organize society. And if you read history, it can be a natural way to think all societies work that way, the powerful and the powerless. But that's how, that's, you know. All hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on in an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. In the earlier epochs of history, we find almost everywhere a complicated arrangement of society into various orders, a manifold gradation of social rank. In ancient Rome, we have patricians, knights, plebeians, slaves. In the Middle Ages, feudal lords, vassals, guildmasters, journeymen, apprentices, and serfs. In almost all these classes, again, subordinate gradations. The modern bourgeois society has sprouted from these ruins of feudal society, has not done away with these class antagonisms. It has, but established new classes, new conditions of oppression, new forms of struggle in place of old ones. That's the introduction to the Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels.
Thank goodness they fixed that.
Fixed what?
That whole condition. They fixed it.
Yeah. Now, remember, I said last night about being interdisciplinary. You got to respect. I don't think Marx came up with the right answers about the dynamics of history, but what he's talking about is not a lie. It's truth. That is how societies appear to be. And we have a problem sometimes when we forget that Esther's become part of the dominant coalition, that Mordecai becomes the political leader and gets to call the shots. We tend to think of these pyramids as fixed, but they're not. Earlier in the month, there was a conference at the World Bank that my co-authors and I organized, applying the framework of the natural state to modern developing societies. 9 cases, 3 in Africa, 2 in Latin America, 2 in South Asia, and 2 in East Asia. And in every single one of the cases, 25 years is a long time. In not one of the countries was the same regime in power or the same constitutional set of arrangements in power for more than 25 years. Okay. Now, part of the challenge I took up on Monday was to say, you know, the reason poor countries are poor is that they go backwards as often as they go forward, especially for the poorest. And the problem is not growing fast, it's growing steady. And I want to try to answer that question about how societies made this transition from being natural states, where their coalitions often break down and are not permanent, but are very transitory, to societies in which, as in America, we've had the same constitution at the national level for 220 years. Turns out we've had 154 state constitutions, which actually govern most of our life, right? Because you drive on roads that are built by state and local governments, you go to schools that are run by state and local governments, you have traffic lights and cops that are run by state and local governments. In fact, most of the government you interact with is your state and local government. And those constitutions have been constantly changing. I'm going to talk about that a little bit today. How do we get there? changes from natural states to what I'm going to call an open access society. And as I've said so far, we need to understand societies as organizations, and as organizations of organizations, and we need to understand rents. One of the problems with having society based on the political manipulation of the economy to create rents is that when the rents get too small and the major actors decide to reallocate things, they don't just reallocate them a little bit. They reallocate them a lot. Amen. He's strung up. His kids are strung up. They're strung up twice. Right? They're killed and then they're hung. About one thing in Rome, they went and got the guy's body out of the river and cut off his head. He was already dead, but they did it again. There's no bill of attainder is in our constitution. Does anybody know what that means? Probably not, because we don't have any bills of attainder anymore.
Convict through a law.
What?
Convict through a law. Has
no.
A law.
No. Now, attainder was a specific form of penalty for treason in England, shared in European countries. When you were tainted, it was in your blood, and so you and your family lost everything. You were tainted. It was through a law, right, through the king's declaring or from Parliament acting, that somebody who was tainted lost everything. And we say in America, we'll have no bills of attainder.
Are there still countries where that operates correctly?
You
where,
bet.
Like in East Germany, I think they rounded up your family and
sure.
relatives or punish your relatives.
Oh, yeah. The whisperers and Stalin and Russia and China. Hey, you know, China's growing, but don't think if you don't screw up that your whole family might not disappear.
I think North Korea is a similar. Yeah.
Right. Lots of places are that way. Okay. This is not, the natural state is not a way to eliminate violence, it's a way to control it. Now, in the society that we live in, we have a different dynamic. It kind of looks similar because we have a thing called the government, we have, you know, corporations and organizations and things. But unlike a natural state where control over violence is dispersed among powerful individuals, and you gotta remember that even in places like the Soviet Union, where the army is really strong, there were still people who were capable of using violence to resist in an organized way. Think about Chechnya. Think about all the things that are going on in those societies. In an open access society, control of the military is consolidated under the government, under a political actor. In most societies, is that a good or bad thing? Think about it. If you're in a natural state, you want the king to have all the military power.
I don't want the military to have all the power.
In a natural state.
Come back to me in 45 minutes. In a natural state, if the king has all the military power and he decides to move against other people, can those people defend themselves? No, by definition, you've given all the king all the military power, all the control over violence, all the ability to organize violence, and people won't be able to defend themselves. So if you're worried that the king might do that, what do? You organize an army. So in England, the dukes and the earls often had armies. In fact, it was part of the evolution of English society to say that the powerful lords could only have 12 liveried retainers, guys who wore their uniforms. Because that was a way to take the military out of the hands of the dominant coalition and put it underneath the king. Now, if you're going to consolidate control of the military under the control of the government, of one faction, what must the other powerful players believe they can do to that faction?
Control it.
But I'm not playing a trick here. Well, that's tricky. By arguing that you consolidate and control the military under one faction, by definition, I'm saying the other factions don't have access to military power. Or they've abandoned it and they've conceded the guns, the weapons to the military faction. They must be able to control the military through non-military means, which are what?
Money.
Don't say money. Because money, if you say money, you divert your attention to the fact that it's about choices. It's about organization. Money is not power. Power is power in our society because the money enables you to command resources. And what is powerful? The resources. The men and women and guns and tanks that the money will get. That's what's powerful. Do you have to have money to get power? No. You need men, women, tanks, guns, and organization to become powerful. We get trapped in saying this is the power. It's not. This is just a piece of paper. That's all it is. It's only powerful because our society and we believe it, that it represents something. So there's plenty of societies with lots of power with no money. In fact, most human societies didn't have any money. The United States is the first country to actually start printing paper money, which says, this is just a piece of toilet paper with Andrew Jackson's picture on it. And guess what? It's worth $20. What does $20 mean? It means whatever you can get with it. It doesn't mean that this piece of paper is valuable. It means that whatever you can get with it is.
But it takes that money to get the resources that you need.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
It doesn't.
If you're in the Congo, Jack, and you want to get control of the diamonds, will money get you control of the diamonds now? No. Troops will. You got to go in there, kick ass, take names, and get the guys who are in power. They're out. And it doesn't matter how much money you have if you have the troops. And if you don't have the troops, it doesn't matter how much money you have.
Don't you have to have money to get the troops to get the guns?
You're thinking our society in which money automatically translates into resources. But in fact, most societies are organized partly through money, but mostly through organizations in which control of resources is allocated through the organization. Our society is not natural. Truth. Would you rather live in our society or a natural state? Our society. Okay? If you want to lower infant mortality, extend people's lives, increase the standard of living in a material sense, can you do it in a natural state? What's the best cure for that? Changing the nature of your society. This is an uncomfortable truth that we have to acknowledge about our society. We may not like certain things about our society, but we cannot deny that it makes the poor and the powerless better off. We cannot deny that. That a poor person in our society who makes $20,000 a year as a family of four and is therefore below the poverty line has more money every year than 80% of the world's population, 90% of the world's population. We can't deny that fact. We can say that our system is wrong, but we can't deny that that's happened. And we want to help the poor and heal the sick. We need to change our society rather than putting good people in Hamas place. Because we got to change the dynamics of our societies. How do we do that? Well, number one, we consolidate control of the military under a government, and that government is dangerous. We all live in America. We know about paranoia about government, right? Let's have a tea party. Hey, look, that's for real. And that's been around all the time. And in fact, are liberals any less paranoid about the government than conservatives? No, just remember Richard Nixon being president. Okay? The Tea Partiers don't have a monopoly on paranoia, all you liberal Lutherans. In fact, remember when you all used to be conservative? No, you don't, because you were kids when your parents were conservative Lutherans, and now you're liberal Lutherans. Right, Mom? She's a Republican. She's a registered Republican, but she's not voted for a Republican in California, and I don't know how long.
Well,
all
my
seat. What? I won't. Only the funny ones. Okay? So, that we have this. competition. We don't like it. It's really messy. Sometimes it's really, really unpleasant because politicians are very often not very courteous to one another. And of course, it's not just the politicians who aren't courteous to one another. The talking heads and the citizens, we all sometimes have uncivil discourse when we talk about politics. But there's competition, and believe me, there is competition. But how do we sustain political competition? What?
Right to free speech.
Do we sustain political competition by enforcing the laws? Now remember, laws don't determine all the relationships. They're just that nub.
Do we sustain political competition with organizations?
Yeah, but what kind?
Well, we limit terms. You can only be in office for so long.
Political organizations.
Well, that's guaranteed.
Political organizations.
Competition for spots.
That doesn't. That can work. Although it typically produces.
Part of it.
Typically produce term limits. Typically produce legislators who don't know what they're doing.
Amen.
That may be a way. How do we sustain political competition? Think about it. What if the government does something to you that adversely affects your interest? How do you respond to that?
Everybody's against it.
What? You organize,
yeah.
All right? And what are the organizations that express interest? Are they all political?
No,
they're mostly economic. Ooh, whoa! Corporations are economic organizations that we fear because of their intense power. What is Holden Village, Paul Hinderle?
Corporation.
A corporation. The first law in America that allowed everybody to form an organization whenever they wanted was passed by New York in 1783, and it was a general law of incorporation for churches. Except in Virginia, in most states, churches are corporations, and they have a law which allows every church, groups of believers, to form their own church and to form a corporation. This is very, very important. But we don't think of it so today because this is the water that we swim in. We don't see it. In order to receive a bequest, bequests can only be given in English common law to legal persons. So if you're a congregation, you are not a legal person. You are a partnership of legal persons. If you want your church to actually be able to receive a bequest, your church must become a legal person. It must become incorporated. In the colonial period, religious tolerance, as was the policy in England. But it turned out that all of the New York colony's history, that only Dutch Reformed and Anglican churches got charters. No discrimination. Just, you know. Second thing, if you are a partnership and you borrow money, every member of the partnership is completely responsible for the total debt. How many of you would like to belong to a congregation that borrows $500,000 to build a sanctuary, in which you potentially are liable for the entire amount? Raise your hand. Nobody. No. What? You want your congregation to be a corporation, so that you share a collective debt, which is not enforceable upon you as an individual, because the legal person that owes the money is the corporation of the congregation. Are congregations that are incorporated evil? No. Does making them a legal person make them evil? No, does it give them a privilege? Yes. It enables the congregation to do something it can't do as individuals, that it can do if it has the privilege of being incorporated. Now, as long as the privilege of forming an organization is limited, or as long as the tools for structuring organizations are limited, then the grant of a corporation charter, and here I'm being using modern terms because in the past it could just be the ability to organize, the consent of the king or the consent of the powerful to live and let live. Right? Ron has his organization, John has his. That either consent or actually positive support, if that support is limited, will create what? Monday night, afternoon. What will happen to the benefits that the people in the group receive?
Rents.
Exactly. Right? By allowing a congregation to incorporate, you generate rents. And if only the Dutch Reformed and the Anglicans can incorporate, they have a real advantage over the Methodists, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, and the Lutherans. Okay? If you're a church in the Soviet Union, if you're Christians in the Soviet Union, can you appear above ground? No, you have to meet in secret. The society does not support your organization at all. In New York, if you were a Methodist or a Baptist, the state would not prosecute you. It would not persecute you for being a Christian. It would let you do it, but it would not provide you with the tools to become better organized. You getting it? Societies provide tools to people to form organizations. And that's the most, I hear I'm going to go out on a limb, it's my own personal opinion, that's the most important source of rents in a limited access society. And that's the most important glue that holds societies together if you're in a natural state. You can see why this is going to have real implications for development policy. Because if we go in and say, you ought to let everybody have a corporation, you're going to undercut the rents and the society's going to go, boom, Congo. Okay? Jack's been in the Congo, so I may pick on him before the end of the hour. Yeah?
Could you briefly describe rents?
Yes, I should. Yes. If we think about, you make a choice, and then when you choose to come to this session, you can't hike. Okay? That's the opportunity cost of not coming to the session. We'll keep it simple. So it's coming to the session or hiking. And you're going to do, and economists would assume, you're going to do that which makes you best off. That is the benefits minus the cost. So you're going to get more benefits from coming to my lecture and cost or not hiking. If you really like this session and you really don't like to hike, you get lots of rents. The difference between the benefits and the costs. But if you're just not sure whether you ought to do one or the other, you're indifferent, you don't get any rents. That is the cost. The benefits foregone from not hiking are exactly equal to the benefits that you get from coming to the session. You get zero rents. People try to maximize rents. They try to maximize net benefits. It's not in money. It's just the choices that we make that shape our decisions. We're trying to do what we think is best for us. Doing what's best for us may be doing what is helping somebody else. This is not about selfishness. This is just about, given our values, what choices do we make? Okay, and rents are the return that we get above the cost of the other alternative. Dan?
Could you comment on the relationship of this to the recent Supreme Court about corporations being
Citizens United
and labor unions being persons?
Right.
Am I right?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. So let me keep that in mind for 10 minutes, and then I think I'll be able to put it on the clock, because if I don't get into this in 10 minutes, I'm going to have problems. Okay. But the Citizens United decision was a Supreme Court decision, I think in March or April, in which they decided that it was, it was about Hillary Clinton. I'll describe it when we get to the 10 minutes. Okay. So what happens in the New York case is the legislature realizes that in order to sustain religious freedom, you need to allow everybody to have a church. It's not just enough to say, you can practice however you want. We actually got to give you the tools to organize your religion. Was America a free religion place in 1790?
No.
Not really. In Massachusetts' first constitution, which was written in 1780, everybody had to tithe. You had to give 10% of your income to the church. There was a list of approved churches. And if you didn't belong to one of those, the state would take your 10% and distribute it among the approved churches. Religious freedom? Not really. Massachusetts was really a theocracy. It was such a bad theocracy that Connecticut and Rhode Island formed out of people who wanted to get out of Massachusetts. So, in America, there was a terrible paranoia that if we adopted a democratic form of government, or what we would call, a democratic republic, in which people voted for representatives, and the representatives together by majority rule decided what the laws should be, what the government would and would not enforce in terms of relationships and behaviors. That what would happen is that a group within the political system would create a privileged economic or political organization, and because that organization got rents from its privilege, they would in turn support the political faction, and a minority of political actors would be able to manipulate economic actors in order to secure a majority of votes and therefore get control of the political system. What does this look like? A natural state. If you read the Founding Fathers and what they are paranoid about and what they fear having a bad natural state. They don't think everybody's really equal. It's rich white dead men, or dead rich white men, writing those laws. Okay. Thomas Jefferson says all men are created equal, including my slaves. You got to think about that one.
Only 3/5 of them were.
That was for representation in a democracy, right? They were still chattel slavery. They weren't even slaves in the good sense. But they were people who were bound to their master. They were property. They were, like these chairs. Buy them, sell them, trade them, slice them, dice them. You got it. You had total property rights over your slave. And the society would, in fact, enforce those rights. And part of the problem getting everybody together was an agreement that slavery would continue to be legal. All the northern states got rid of it. Now, in this frame of reference, you can read the Federalist Papers, particularly Federalist 9, which was written by Hamilton, Federalist 10, which was written by Madison, or Washington's Farewell Address, which was written by Hamilton, but delivered by Washington. There's no reason. Washington was a pretty smart guy. He wasn't just mouthing what Hamilton wrote. What do they say is the thing to fear the most?
Faction.
Faction. Groups with a special interest that's not the same as the interest of the whole society. Tell me a group that's not interested in its own interest rather than the welfare of the entire society. Okay? Because even if we're Christians, we see the welfare of society through our history. Our history. What's good for me is good for America. It's hard for us to see it any other way. So they were worried about factions. In his Farewell Address, Washington warned against political parties explicitly as factions and economic organizations explicitly as factions, and they were worried that organized economic and political interests would take over their democracy. So they write this constitution, which was written when? Peter?
1867.
Yeah, 1867, no, 1787.
1787.
What, was that the first or the second constitution? It was the second. The first one was the Articles of Confederation, which was written in 1777 and ratified in 1781. And that didn't work. It created too weak a central government. So they write this constitution, and we all, to this day, believe in that constitution. Right? Does that constitution say anything about corporations?
No.
Say anything about organizations? Does it even say anything about the freedom to associate?
No,
it doesn't. Although we all believe it does. In fact, Peter said that the other night about the First Amendment, that it gives us the right to speech, to free speech and association. But it's not in there that we can freely associate, that we can form groups that the state will support. Because that happened at the state level. Okay. In fact, after 1787 and 1789, the first Congress comes into place. America's doing great, maybe. You know, it's hard to tell. In the 1820s, as a result of the Napoleonic Wars, Spain is occupied by France. Napoleon's brother is put on the throne. What happens to the Spanish colonies in Mexico and South? They're not abandoned. The powerful's head is turned, his attention is elsewhere. They rise up and become independent. And many of those countries adopt our national constitution. In some cases, big chunks, word for word. Does it produce political and civil rights in those countries? No. Because our Constitution is a simple framework which limits the federal government And all those guarantees and the bills of rights apply to the federal government. Until the Civil War, they did not apply to state governments. So states could violate individual civil rights, and the Supreme Court would say, you know, that's really a state matter. Because the Ninth Amendment says all power is not explicitly given to the federal government or reserved to the states and the people. And that was how it was interpreted. And the states were deadly worried about this problem of corruption. And I'm going to draw two words here. Systematic corruption and venal corruption. We use both of these words to describe, we don't use either of these words. We just use corruption as if we all understood what it meant. But we don't. In early 19th century America, when they talked about corruption, they meant systematic corruption. They talked about the polity, politics corrupting economics in order to maintain power in the economics, in the political system. Politics corrupting economics. The kind of corruption that we're worried about today is venal, which is economics corrupting politics. Right? We're worried about the Citizens United case because we're worried these powerful corporations will get a voice that's bigger and they will corrupt the political process. Washington, Hamilton, Madison were worried about systematic corruption, so they said, be careful about organized interests. Because by creating an organization, you create a rent which can be used to manipulate people's interests and get control of our democratic republic. All the states had problems with this. They shared a common language. Guess what the French Revolution in 1789, they write the first constitution in 1791. And in the prologue to that constitution, they banned corporations three times. Because the French are so convinced that organized political and economic institutions are what are preventing liberty, fraternity, and equality from being there. This is not just an American thing. This is a Western European thing. So what happens is states face this real dilemma, which is there's all these Lutherans out there that want charters for their churches. There's these people out there who want to form a union, or they want to form a logging association, or they want to form a mine, and they want to have a corporate form to be able to do that. So you're a democracy, and you want to give people what they want that you think is legitimate, but if you grant a charter to one group, you create a privilege for that group that may distort the political process. So one possibility is don't grant anybody any charters. Don't make any organizations legitimate. But then we're stuck with the dynamics of the natural state. Because the politically favored will be well organized, and the political unfavored will not be, and the well organized will dominate society. So what happens in the 1830s, there's a severe economic depression. There's a financial panic, much like the one that happened in 2008 and 1837. There's a depression that starts in 1839. Several states have borrowed lots of money. They've gone into debt to build canals or railroads or to invest in banks. And they go bankrupt. Eight states in the territory of Florida go bankrupt in 1841 and 1842. We're like a banana republic. And the states sit down and say, what happened? How did we get into this problem? And they've got this lens of corruption that they apply. And they say, you know, the problem is that if we charter a corporation to build the canal, and we give that corporation credit, the state's credit, our common credit, that is, we let them raise money by selling state bonds that all the taxpayers may have to cover, that creates a privileged interest, which may distort our politics. But more importantly, we realize that legislatures, democratically elected legislatures and voters, cannot resist the appeal of somebody who comes in and says, if the state gives me $5 million in bonds, I will build a bank, and the bank will pay off the interest and principal on the bonds, and actually, since we'll pay you the state dividends, your taxes will go down. How good are citizens at resisting things that appear to be too good to be true because they think their taxes are going to go down? Think supply-side economics. Right? They're not. So what happened in the 1840s was a series of constitutional changes. There were 12 new constitutions written in existing states in the 1840s. And all except for Virginia said, if you're going to borrow money, you have to specify what the money is going to go for, and you have to go to the voters and have them approve a tax increase sufficient to service the bonds for the life of the bonds. In other words, people have to approve higher taxes in order to borrow. We could use that today. We could have used it particularly over the last 30 years. Because since Reagan was elected, it's the only time in American history in which we've run up large peacetime deficits. Because the promise was that if we cut taxes, the economy will grow, and the economy will grow enough to get tax revenues to pay off the debts that we borrowed because we cut taxes. The last 30 years have proven that that is wrong. I'm not going to go there because then I won't have 10 minutes.
Right.
But the other thing that had to happen then was you had to resist appeals from private groups who asked for special favors like a charter that might give a monopoly to a railroad or a bridge or a church. Because if a private group comes and says, give us some privileges and we'll provide the public good for free, then you're not going to be able to resist this kind of systematic corruption. And so 8 of those states mandated that their legislatures pass general laws allowing everybody to form a corporation through an administrative procedure by paying a couple $100 or whatever the fee was in those days. Every state in the union now has a general law like that, and every state you can go and form a corporation at will through a legal proceeding, which you do not have to have special legislation. You just do not have to go to the state legislature to have them grant you the privilege of a charter. Now, I'm focusing on business corporations because it's easiest for us to see the notion of a charter. This also applied to municipal governments. It had always applied to families, right? Because the state would allow anyone to form a family at will, but who was the legal person in the family? The head of the household. The king's doing. So after the 1840s, those laws began to change. What the family was as an organization began to change as women got rights to property in divorce. Political parties were not actually made legal until the 1880s. Americans so feared political parties that they wrote no laws about them. They would not legitimate political parties by saying, this is how you form it. Now notice what happens. And here I'll get to Dan's example. Dan's question about Citizens United. Notice what happens to the dynamic of society when you let everybody form an organization. What happens to the dominant coalition? Because what holds the dominant coalition together? Rents. And if you allow everybody to have a corporation, what kind of rents do you get from your organization? Very small. Because if you form an organization to do something that brings in a lot of money, or brings in a lot of happiness, or brings in a lot of welfare, somebody else will say, hey, I can do that too. Let me form a corporation to do that, or let me form a church, or let me form an organization. And in fact, we see that in the history of American religion. Right? We are an extremely religious nation, in part because anybody who wants to can form a church to be religious about anything they want to. As long as you're not killing people, it's okay. In fact, what's the one thing that organized groups cannot use? They cannot do. They cannot be violent. Because you've consolidated that power with inside the government. And that really, really dangerous government, which could wipe us all out, send one of those F-16s or A-10s, bomb Holden Village, we'd be gone. The government is constrained by a political system that's subject to political competition, but political competition is guaranteed because anybody who's pissed off at the government can form an organization and resist. Not just by forming a political party, but by forming an economic corporation. Now, Citizens United says that a corporation is a person. Turns out that all corporations are legal persons, and this goes back to the code of to Roman times. They've always had that. In fact, the church is what? It's the body and blood of Christ. It's also a corporation. It's a person. It's a legal person. There's a constitution of the Lutheran Church. It has a legal form. It's our decision as Lutherans or Methodists or whatever to decide what our constitutional structure is going to be. But the form of the organization is a corporation sustained by the largest society. corporations have always been legal persons, entities that could sue and be sued, hold property and sell property. That's not new, that use of a person. The Constitution did not use the word person very often, it used the word citizen. And not every person in the United States is a citizen. This is one of the problems with immigration. But the 14th Amendment during the Civil War said that states shall not deprive persons of due process of law. And that's a different word than citizen. So if you are a slave and you are not a citizen, you are still a person, and the Constitution applies to you. The government shall not deprive you, the person, of the rights to due process of law. Because, in fact, there was this ongoing battle about whether slaves were persons or property. And the radical Republicans were intent upon preventing the slough slave-owning states from reimposing it. So the constitutional guarantee is no longer for citizens, it's for persons. And that's where Citizens United comes in. They made a movie about Hillary. I forget what the court, Citizens United was a PAC, it was a political action committee that made a movie about Hillary Clinton, which suggested you shouldn't vote for her. I haven't seen the movie. I forget who brought the original case against them, whether it was the Federal Election Commission or not, that this was, as a corporation, they could not do this. Particularly, it violated, they were releasing the movie within a certain time period before the election in which this kind of activity of corporations is banned under the election law. These election laws go back at the national level to the 1900s. 1900. States had prohibited corporations from doing a bunch of stuff well back into the 19th century. In fact, in the United States, states charter 99.9% of all corporations. But corporation law is not national law. It's almost all state law. And if you're a really big corporation, you're almost certain to be incorporated in Delaware, which has the best laws for corporations. Oh, that's corrupt. No, it's not corrupt. What Delaware is doing is it's providing a very sophisticated set of courts for corporations to deal with each other, in large part. So Citizens United said, the Federal Election Commission said, you can't do this. This kind of political speech by a corporate body is illegal. Not unconstitutional, but illegal. And the dissenting opinion, the opinion of the court was that this was a violation of the speech rights of the legal person of this corporation. Scalia wrote a consenting opinion, and Stewart wrote a dissenting opinion, in which they said, Scalia said, look, this is a simple First Amendment case. Corporations are legal persons, and therefore, they have the right to free speech. The recently retired justice is
Stevens.
I keep wanting to say Stewart, and they're not Stewart. Stevens wrote a dissent, and actually, Scalia wrote in the affirming decision of rebuttal to the dissent by Stevens. Stevens said, Americans always distrusted corporations, and so the states, when they created them, never let them have this kind of political speech. That was something that they did not possess, because the corporation is a creature of the state. It's an entity that the society creates. And Scalia said, that's crazy. Corporations have always been persons. They always should have had this right. And they all cited a bunch of stuff. What neither one of them said, which would have been more powerful, is that what we've always said about corporations is that they're a specific form of organization whose powers are delineated in the Chartering Act. And once we went to general incorporation and their powers were the same for all corporations, and states did not give these entities the right to free speech. And nobody ever questioned that these corporations did not have the right to political speech. And the Supreme Court said in 1903 and some other places, look, this is how states regulate this thing is okay. That these bodies are created there, they haven't been given this power. If they are given this power, maybe we've got to worry about it. And so Scalia's opinion and the majority consent is giving corporations a power and essentially forcing states to say, if you create a corporation, it must have the power of political speech. Now, how's that going to work out? I don't know. And I suspect that some states are going to start putting provisions in their chartering acts which say, these corporations cannot exercise political speech, which would solve the problem, because the Supreme Court would never say states don't have the power to create organizations. Because that's a fundamental power that in the Ninth Amendment is reserved to the states. So is that clear?
But so then they shop around for the state to...
Yeah, that's sometimes called race to the bottom.
So
race to
the
top.
Delaware will allow it. It won't make any difference.
Maybe. I okay. Why Christians must think. Silly time. These sessions start at 10:50. Not one of these sessions has started at 10:50 because we're always out there saying goodbye to the bus. What determines the dynamics of politics and economics is the structure of organizations that people can form to influence the polity and to act in the economy. And when you open access to organizational forms, you do not create universal access, that everybody is equal in all kinds of senses. But what you say on this dimension, everybody is the same. Now, everybody the same means we treat people equally, which is a warm and fuzzy word. But it also means we treat people impersonally, which is a cold and hard word. Open access means treating people impersonally. Only if we have open access to organizations can the political system be effectively disciplined so that it actually obeys the rules. And what kind of rules do we want? Impersonal rules that apply equally to everyone. No state had a clause in its constitution until Indiana in 1851 that said, all laws that the state passes for a whole wide variety of purposes should be general laws, by which they meant laws that apply equally to everyone. Every corporation is the same, every city is the same, every divorce is the same, every family is the same. The legislature cannot create a special deal for you. It cannot create rents for you. Because if it can create rents by giving people a special deal, then the political system can manipulate the economy and democracy will go right out the window. We'll still be voting, right? But control of the political system will have passed from the voters, not necessarily the politicians, to those elites. We're able to manipulate that process. Yeah.
But you constantly see individuals trying to get an exception for them personally. I watched a guy in the street the other day not pay for parking, go into Starbucks. The guy comes up, gives him the ticket, and he comes out and demands a special exception for him as an individual because blah, blah, blah.
That's
blah.
Right. And that
and
is what?
Yeah.
That is human nature.
Yeah.
The laws cannot change that. The laws do not describe our behavior. And we got to get that idea out of our head.
Yeah.
That how we act is determined by the law. No, the law is there so that when our relationships break down, we got some default arrangements that we can, and hopefully, under rule of law, we can all know what the laws are and that they will apply equally to everyone. That provision is not in the National Constitution. It's equal protection under the laws means that the laws of the states apply to all other states. It doesn't say that a state has to have a law which applies equally to everyone. Get it? The Constitution does not guarantee that everybody will be treated the same. Just says that if a state passes a law, it has to apply equally to the citizens of that state and other states. But it could apply unequally to the citizens within one state. By implementing open access to organizations, we sustain an economic and political system which is capable of enforcing impersonality. That means that markets are going to be much more powerful ways of organizing human behavior because everybody is going to be treated the same. It means if you want to enter a field that's dominated by a current large firm, that large firm cannot prevent you from entering. If you can produce goods at lower cost, you'll drive the other firm out of business. Microsoft started in a garage. It wasn't a huge corporation to begin with. It was a couple of guys. Same thing with Google. Sergey Brin grew up on a street away from where we live. He was just a kid. Now that kind of dynamism, you don't see, you know, like in Mexico today, there's only 60 firms listed on the stock exchange. That's it. And over half of them have been in existence for over 60 years. And Mexico is a natural state. It's not an open access society. Now, what happens is we don't like some of the aspects of the society that we have because it's impersonal. And we say we want equality, but sometimes we say we want equality means we want everybody's needs to be met, even if they're different. But if we do that, if we decide to have government policies that treat everybody individually differently, then we really put at risk the possibility that the rules will be impartial. And only if the rules are impartial and everybody has a chance to access the rules, and everybody doesn't have to be everybody, it might only be all white males, slaves until 1860, women can't vote until 1914, but if there's enough people in the society to produce competition, then open access can sustain a kind of political and economic system which can, in fact, sustain impersonality. And what we want from governments is not care. We want fairness in the sense that we want the government to treat everybody the same. Do we always get justice out of that? No. Because justice is a really complicated thing. And in fact, if you say different the just solution is different for individuals of different incomes or different sexes or different races or whatever, then bingo, you put that impersonality at risk. It may be beneficial to do that. I'm not saying it isn't. We got to think. Because if we want to make children healthier, the best thing in the world to do this is become an open access society. Not having the government go and say, here, let's go give inoculations to everybody. And we need to think about societies not just as individuals. Christ comes to us as individuals. He, grace, comes to us as an individual. But what would Christ do to change the society? He'd understand that there are organizations. He wouldn't be so stupid as to say, it's just a matter of making people good. He'd read the book of Esther. And he'd realize that the organizations that we're in create our choices. And no matter what our values are, it's the choices that we have that are going to determine, in some sense, which options appear to be best. And we can have the right values. We can be Esther and Mordecai. But when confronted with a set of choices, we might go out and murder 75,000 non-Jews. Because we believe that persecuted, and that's a just outcome, just war, just complicated, right? We have to think about how societies are organized. We cannot assume that our society is natural, and that but for bad people, the Congo would be just like the United States. If we go to those places and we say they're corrupt and that's why they're poor, we forget that the reason they're corrupt is because that's how we define corruption. And that's how their system works. It's not a great system, but they're stuck with it. They got to grow out of it. They got to have the investiture crisis. They got to have the great schism. They have to figure out the problems. The question today about Israel and Palestine, why can't the United States solve that problem? We can't solve that problem because it's not our problem. It's their problem. We can help, but God knows what we should do because we don't understand them. We understand we'd like them to be more like us, but telling them to be more like us ain't going to solve their problem. And sometimes we have way inflated expectations that if they just live like us, things will get better. That's worshiping ourselves.
Oh.
Okay,
Okay, so we are influencing the outcomes.
Look, we are influencing outcomes everywhere, right?
No one would say that our military help is solving the problem.
No, certainly not.
Well, some people,
you know, I mean, it's like that's the thing we're trying, but.
Okay, what I want you to do is not get pissed off about the one thing that's wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, but think about how the system works. Christians have to do that, because sometimes you got to take some bad to get the good. We may not like our politics. We may not like an impersonal society. But without that, we don't get healthy children. Okay? We don't get the things that we have that we take for granted. Because we have them because we've changed the organization of our society. I'm not saying that other societies should be like us, because in fact, their ability to do this is going to depend upon how they are organized. But we got to think about this. We got to think about this, because we can't just say, that's wrong, and therefore we shouldn't do it, without understanding how the pieces fit together. Thank you.